afternoon and welcome to the last Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for this special session. We could hold over if the senators would like, but no. So we have up on the agenda today four bills. The first one up is House Bill 3602A, and we have a STEAM representative that would like to come up to speak on that bill. So we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 3602A. And Beth, if you want to provide us with an overview.
House Bill 3602A directs that a hydroelectric license continues in effect if the project is located in Umatilla County. The transfer of license rights or property is to Umatilla County. The transfer results from foreclosure of a tax lien, and the transfer occurred on or before January 1st, 2010. You should have in your packet an A5 amendment, and there was a minimal fiscal impact on that amendment as well as a no revenue impact. There's also in your packet a letter of support on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation.
Okay. Thank you, Beth. And we have the representative, I believe, from Umatilla County would like to come up. Robin, would you mind if I called Martha up at the same time?
I was going to ask if you would.
Okay, certainly. Ms. Pagel. Good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon, members. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, for the opportunity to bring Senate Bill 3602, if I'm correct here, before the committee. I'm not going to say much about it. There are some technical things that perhaps Martha might be able to provide information if somebody is interested in it, but it has to do, the bill has to do with a little hydro operation or plant that was in, or that is in the Umatilla River, just outside of the community of Stanfield in eastern Oregon, which falls in right in my district, and the plant went through some apparently rough times and had gotten behind on their property taxes to a point that the county had to foreclose, and this began to raise all sorts of problems for them. And since there are a lot of problems, I would leave that to people much more adept at dealing with those problems than I am to present those to you. So the only thing I think Martha's done an absolutely outstanding job of trying to get all of the people together that might have any involvement or any interest in this, from the environmental community to the tribes to the county, which in the county is the one that has the liability that they're trying to be able to resolve at this point. But and from everything I can understand, she's gotten pretty much unanimous agreement that this is the route to go, and it's something that will not affect other parts of the state of Oregon. Thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity, and I'd be glad to answer any questions, but I think you'd be better served to listen to esteemed counsel on those.
Thank you, Representative, and stick around in case there were a couple of questions. That would be great.
Thank you.
Martha?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Martha Pagel. I'm an attorney with Schwabe Williamson and Wyatt, and I'm representing Umatilla County. And first, on behalf of the commissioners, I want to express their thanks to you in hearing the bill, and also to Representative Jensen in helping the county deal with what otherwise would have been a problem, but I think we're on our road to a good solution here. Finally, want to thank the members of a work group who we pulled, an informal work group that we pulled together on the House side, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Basically, with this bill in place, the small hydroelectric project, it's called the Boyd Hydroelectric Project, it will be on a path that it can continue to operate as a hydroelectric project. Without the bill, because of state law, current state law and current provisions in Water Resources Department rules, that are carried forward in the license would have to be terminated upon the foreclosure on the project. And in this case, the county had potential buyers who were stepping forward and willing to take on the project and a real desire to keep it in operation for at least the remainder of the term of its state and FERC licenses. And the county initially presented this bill from a more general standpoint, as you would typically do. You write it to amend state law generally. When it was first heard on the House side, a lot of concerns were expressed by the Umatilla tribes, by Water Watch of Oregon, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, primarily from the standpoint of concerns that this is an old project, had been operating for a long time, and if it's going to continue to operate, they wanted to see more up-to-date provisions for fish screening and fish passage, and just overall kind of have a tighter set of conditions that would apply to the project. And so following the first hearing, we formed a work group that included those interests along with Oregon Water Resources Department, and I represented the county. And we worked through those issues and developed as consensus amendments that were adopted on the House side and that are now incorporated in the bill. And basically what the upshot of all that was is that it narrowed the scope. So if you read this bill, it's got a lot of qualifiers on it that really make it applicable to this project in Umatilla County. It does allow the county to transfer the ownership and makes it clear that the license would not be automatically terminated either as a result of the statute or as 543-440 or as a result of terms that are in the license itself. So it protects it from cancellation or termination so long as these various conditions are met. Among those conditions are that if the county does transfer it to the new owners, that they have to prepare a plan for dealing with the fish screening and fish passage issues. The plan is presented to ODFW for approval, and ODFW then consults with the tribes. And upon approval by ODFW, that plan is incorporated as a condition on the license. It has to include certain provisions if ODFW requires them for upgrades that will be made before the project resumes operation, and it has to ensure that the project comes up to current criteria for fish screening and fish passage within 4 years. The 4 years gives the operators all the time to generate some revenue to put in place the new provisions. So we think as a work group we came up with a good common sense approach that allows this existing project to continue. We did miss one small thing in our rush to get our consensus amendments developed, and that's what you see before you in the A5 amendments. I don't know if this is the time to go into that, but basically it makes a wording change to clarify that the license, the project license, is not terminated as opposed to the water right, which is embedded in the license.
I saw that.
I want to finally just express my thanks and thanks on behalf of the county to the work group members. They all came together in a really good spirit of cooperation. I think we are able to deliver a good product to you.
Okay, thank you. Questions for either representative? Okay. I just have a couple, and you're the only one signed up, so I'm assuming that there's other folks in the room that were part of the work group, and since this is consensus, they've all said we don't need to testify. But first of all, I want to thank you for your work. You know, I've been sort of following this through my through the chair on the House side, and he's been keeping me abreast of what's been happening on that, along with staff. We do share a staff, which does help on most occasions. Sometimes it's too much information now.
Push pull.
We're lucky because we can coordinate on bills coming over, actually. So, but I just want to clarify, I think I'm reading this right, line 22 on the first page. So this water right would be subordinate.
Yes, I think. Chair members of the committee, one of the specific provisions that we incorporated in as a result of the work group was that the hydroelectric license and the water right become subordinate to the in-stream water right, existing in-stream water right.
So follow-up question is, so what is the date of, what's the priority date of that water right now? I mean, initially it would have been whenever the license or the I don't know if the water right was issued prior to the license of the project, but I'm just curious if there's going to be a new date. And I know we have the department here, so I don't know if that's something they could address.
Senator Dingfeld, the members of the committee, I don't have that right in front of me. The license was issued in approximately 1985 and has that priority date. The in-stream water right has a more recent, more junior priority date. The license was made subordinate, as hydro licenses typically are subordinate to all other out-of-stream uses, mm-hmm. but not to the in-stream uses, and that's why this change was made. I don't know the priority date of the in-stream water right.
Okay. Well, maybe we can have the department follow up and let me know about that, since I see Dwight is here. The other is, I just want to make sure, so in state law, the state license would be canceled, but under federal law, that's not so with a FERC license. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. The state law has a provision that has an automatic termination as a result of foreclosure. There's no similar provision in FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, but FERC had begun a process to consider whether they should terminate the license as well. And that process has been on hold pending what happened with the state.
Okay. And as far as any of the costs, at this time, since it won't have to be relicensed, but would that be borne by the county, or is that going to be borne? I was just reading through your testimony, so I didn't know if I picked up by the new owner.
Madam Chair of the committee,
it
would be the cost of any relicensing and upgrades to the project would be borne by the new owners. The county is not intending to and never has intended to assume operation of the project. In fact, it's their position that they didn't really acquire the license and would have to go through some process to acquire the license, which they don't want to do.
Okay. Well, I think this is a good compromise. I'm pleased to see that the tribes and conservation groups and have come together and supported this, and I'm pleased to see the narrowness of this bill, too, mm-hmm. because obviously we don't want to set a precedent in the future for all projects. I mean, there's a reason why we have that in statute, so appreciate it. Any other questions? No. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. And is there anyone else who'd like to testify on this bill? Okay, with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3602. I'll open up a work session on House Bill 3602 and
Madam
would
Chair,
accept a motion. Yep.
Move the dash A5s into House Bill 3602.
Senator Przanski moves adoption of the dash A5s into House Bill 3602. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3602 as amended on the A5s to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Przanski moves House Bill 3602 as amended with the dash 5s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, motion carries, and I will carry the bill to the floor. Okay, with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3602, and we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 3606A. Beth?
Madam Chair, committee members, House Bill 3606A modifies provisions related to the determination of return share and return share by weight of televisions in the electronics recycling program. There is a no revenue impact statement and on this bill, as well as a fiscal statement has been issued, which you should have in front of you. Also in your packet is a letter from Thompson in support of the bill and a handout from the Department of Environmental Quality explaining the provisions of the bill.
Okay, and I'm going to ask Palmer, Mason, and Justin Martin to come up, please. So, colleagues, this is, you're going to hear a little bit more about the proposed changes, but if you recall, in 2007?
Yeah.
The e-waste recycling bill passed the House and the Senate unanimously. Since that time, we've been collecting millions of pounds through the program, and I think Palmer is going to provide a little bit more background on that before we talk about why this amendment is being proposed to the existing statute.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. My name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. Yes, I can speak to the success of the program. We originally had a goal, and in this I should stop and say this is the information from the 2009 year, which was the first year of the program. We had a goal originally of collecting about 12.2 million pounds of e-waste, and the actual results when they came in were almost 19 million town. So I would say the program was very successful.
And that's
not to overstate DEQ's role in that. That's largely a success that was borne out by the manufacturers, TV and IT manufacturers. They are the ones who provided the network and had paid for the collection and recycling. So really the lion's share of credit goes to them for the success of the program. But it has been very successful. And interestingly, if you convert that number of pounds of e-waste into greenhouse gases, it equates to about, and I see Senator Boker smiling on that.
I'm a yes vote right now. So.
Yeah. It's about 30,000 cars, the annual emissions of about 30,000 cars. And it also equates to something in the order of 1 million-plus pounds of lead that have been kept out of landfills. So it has quite a bit of environmental impact.
And did you want to just remind the committee members what the original bill covered and why there was the language that is in the existing statute versus what's being proposed? I think that would be helpful. Because I'm probably the only person up here that understands that otherwise, but...
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. My name is Loretta Pickerall. I'm a manager of solid waste at DEQ, and I will try to answer your question. The Oregon's electronics recycling law requires manufacturers of computers, monitors, and TVs to fund a program to provide free recycling of those devices in Oregon. Manufacturers must either pay a fee and participate in the state contractor program or join a manufacturer-run program which pays its own costs. Now, every year, DEQ determines the total weight of electronic devices expected to be collected the following year, and we assign each manufacturer a portion of that weight as its return share, and the return share is each manufacturer's minimum recycling obligation. Under the law, the return shares are based on the percentage of the manufacturer's devices coming through the recycling system. Each manufacturer then takes its return share to its recycling program. DEQ also uses those return shares to assess recycling fees to the manufacturers that come to the state contractor program in order to cover the costs of that program. But we assess fees differently for TV manufacturers than for other or IT manufacturers. And TV manufacturers are those that manufacture more TVs than computers and monitors. The IT manufacturers pay their collective share of the state program's recycling costs based on their return shares. TV manufacturers pay their collective share of costs based on their respective market share, which is the respective percentage of annual sales of all TVs in the state. Now, what this looks like is, at the outset, then, we DEQ determine the total weight to be collected the following year we expect to be collected. We then assign every manufacturer a return share of that weight based on the percentage of returns coming, their devices coming through our recycling system. The manufacturer then takes that return share to whatever program it chooses. For those coming to the state contractor program, we then have to assess a recycling fee. And we assess that fee then to the IT manufacturers based on their return share. But for TV manufacturers, we determine what their collective return share obligation is, and we distribute that fee among them to base it on market share. So they're paying a fee based on market share.
And Loretta, I just want to clarify for the record, too, that was at the request of the TV manufacturers, and Justin Martin, who you will hear from in a minute, was not working for them at the time, but I spent hours and hours and hours, days, locked in a room with them because they wanted this language. So I just want to make it clear that that was why the language was different for the TV manufacturers, just for the record, than for the IT manufacturers.
Chief Dingfelder, thank you. Under this scheme, TV manufacturers in the state contractor program that have market share, that is those currently selling TVs, pay for the recycling costs of all the TV manufacturers in the state contractor program. And the former TV manufacturers in that program, who are no longer selling TVs and so have no market share, pay no fees, even though they bring substantial return shares and therefore recycling costs to that program. Now, DEQ has made this recycling fee system work for the past 2 years. But as the TV manufacturers have realized that they face a significant risk of paying substantially higher fees in the state contractor program than they would have to pay if they were in a manufacturer-run program, they've joined manufacturer programs, which is understandable.
Sure.
But as a consequence...
Senator Hash has a question.
Said, if I could back up, why does that one group pay no fees but still have material?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Hash. The TV manufacturers were all assigned a return share at the outset of the program. Those that come to the state contractor program, by law, we have to assess them a fee based on their market share. And so we take all the return shares for the TV manufacturers in the state contractor program, and we reallocate those return shares based on market share, and we assess a fee based on that. So only those TV manufacturers that are currently selling TVs pay any fees. The ones that are no longer selling TVs no longer pay any fees, even though they did manufacture TVs at one time and their TVs are still coming through the recycling system.
They're the orphan TVs,
yes.
We call them.
Yes. And
they don't have parents anymore.
Yes. And I think if we want to discuss this
like
further...
Like the TVs in the Hash household.
Yes.
Which you can take now and then. Yeah, anyway.
Okay. So anyway, as a consequence, almost all the TV manufacturers with market share are now in manufacturer-run programs, while those with no market share but with return shares are in a state contractor program where they pay no fees, even though they brought considerable cost to the program. So in 2011, TV manufacturers in the state contractor program will likely have only 3% of the TV market share statewide. And given this trend, DEQ expects that in 2011, there will be too few TV manufacturers with market share that remaining in the state contractor program to be able to cover the entire TV manufacturer's share of recycling costs for that program. To illustrate that, TV manufacturers in the state contractor program will have 26% of the return shares of all TV manufacturers in the state, but they will have only 3% of market share to pay for that recycling. That means that those TV manufacturers with 3% of market share will pay $1 million to recycle 3.4 million tons of devices, or million pounds of devices, at an unreasonably high cost per market share. The TV manufacturer with the largest market share in the state contractor program will have 1.9% of market share. That TV manufacturer will be assessed a fee of $664,000 for 2.1 million pounds of recycling. Now, in contrast, 97% of the market share of TVs will be with manufacturers that are in manufacturer-run programs, but they will have to pay for only 74% of the total return shares of all TV manufacturers in the state. That means they will be paying $2.8 million for 9.2 million pounds of recycling, which is a dramatically lower cost per market share than the manufacturers in the state contractor program will have to pay. In fact, it's about 10 times less than the fees for the manufacturers in the state contractor program. So the House Bill 3606A amendments resolve this problem for the state contractor program, and they do it in this way. First, the 3606A changes the way that return shares are determined for all TV manufacturers. Currently, as we describe, return shares for all manufacturers, TV and IT, are based on the percentage of devices coming through the recycling system. Under House Bill 3606A, the return shares for all TV manufacturers will be based on their market share, their percentage of annual sales of all TV manufacturers in the state. The result of this is that the return shares for most TV manufacturers in the state will change under this bill. Some will go up, some will go down. And the total return shares for all recycling programs that have participating TV manufacturers, including the state contractor program, will similarly change. IT manufacturers will not be affected by this bill.
Okay.
The bill also makes conforming changes in how recycling fees for TV manufacturers in the state contractor program are determined. So as described earlier, under current law, all TV manufacturers get a return share based on their percentage of devices returned for recycling, but they pay fees based on market share. What this bill does is simply say that the return shares for all TV manufacturers in the state will be based on their market share, and so the recycling fees for TV manufacturers in the state contractor program will also be based on those return shares. And that means that every TV manufacturer bringing return shares to the state program will be paying recycling fees to cover the cost of those of recycling those return shares. And that's what fixes the revenue problem for our program. And finally, House Bill 3606 includes some administrative changes that expand the types of data DEQ can use in determining market share, and it authorizes DEQ to require TV manufacturers to provide sales data when we need it. It authorizes DEQ to add a surcharge to TV manufacturers' registration fees so that we can recoup the costs of determining their return shares based on market share. And it makes the amendments effective for determining return shares for the year 2011 and beyond. And those changes simply allow DEQ to have better information on which to base our market share determinations.
Mm. Mark, Justin, why don't you go ahead and then we'll see if there's questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Justin Martin. I'm here today on behalf of Thompson Incorporated, which is associated with the RCA brand. Thank you very much for this opportunity. We've been working with DEQ. They have been wonderful, and I'm sure Palmer's tired of me calling him 2 to 3 times a week, which I have over the past 4 months now. So thank you very much again for this opportunity. As you mentioned, it is a technical fix, one in which I was not involved with, but we didn't get that language right then, so that's why we're back. Another quick point, all states since the Oregon plan have adopted the market share policy, and then finally we feel that this does level the playing field. So we are here today in full support of House Bill 3606, and again appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? I know everyone's probably thoroughly confused. This is why we pass the laws and you implement them. But
are you carrying it, Madam Chair?
Yes, I have a feeling about that. I want to thank you for your hard work on this, and I could tell that Palmer's happy. He's not going to get phone calls maybe as often from Justin, maybe after this. But I do appreciate the hard work of the department. I know you've been working for several years and getting the program up and running, and we're still, I think, working out some of the bugs. So I'm glad we were able to come back here and fix this, and certainly glad that the TV manufacturers are coming forward with a positive solution as well that'll work for them. So appreciate that. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on this from DEQ or otherwise? Do you know? Okay, that's all that we have signed up, correct? Anybody else out there that would like to testify?
Someone's running up here.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing.
I'd like you to go to a no.
And House Bill 3606A, open up a work session on House Bill
3606A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Przanski moves House Bill 3606A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Two things. One, I think you were a bit modest in the beginning with that 2000 legislation. You were the driving force behind it. Probably wouldn't have passed without you, so thank you for your leadership on that. And two, I'm very proud of this state and the way this is being taken care of, particularly with DEQ. And I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't say I wish we had the same kind of governmental energy and infrastructure to battle litter, which seems a little quaint these days when you talk about computers and televisions in the waste room that we didn't have to think about 40 years ago when households only had one television that they had for 20 years and nobody had portable computers. But even though we've advanced technologically and we have to worry about these things, it doesn't mean that we can forget about people who leave things on the beach or throw things out the car window or don't recycle their plastic bags. And this is a huge problem, and I wish we could attack it with the same vigor and energy that we're attacking some of the more modern problems that we have.
Well, thank you, Senator Hassan. Thank you for the accolades on the bill, on the original 2007 bill. It was a joint effort, but as you can tell, we've been receiving very positive results with the millions of pounds that we've been recycling instead of going into the landfill. And I'd be remiss if I didn't also say that I'm glad to hear DEQ talking about the amount of greenhouse gases that are reduced as part of that as well. We will be talking about a broader scope on product stewardship, and that is where I think the plastic bag issue can and probably will come back for a discussion as well. But I certainly encourage you to not get discouraged, because we are working very closely with DEQ and making sure that we look at the entire waste stream in ways we can continue to maximize the resources, minimize the impacts both to our environment and limited landfill space, and certainly I think that is the intent. I will also say that part of what's happened with this bill is we've been able to also create a number of jobs in the community. I don't know if we have the total number yet, but I've certainly been to and aware of recycling facilities that have started up since the passage of this bill. And I would be remiss if I didn't thank all of the manufacturers who, in the end, came to consensus and supported the bill. And I certainly appreciate that effort moving forward and the continued hard work of DEQ. But I do agree that we need to have a much higher concerted effort when it comes to product stewardship. And this bill is a great start, so hopefully we can continue down that path. Any other comments?
We need to vote, ma'am.
Very quickly.
Okay, so any objections? Seeing none. Work session, the bill passes. I will carry it to the floor because I don't want to subject anybody else to have to explain this. And
burn to the chair no matter what.
We will close the work session on House Bill 3606A. Next, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3701. We'll do that one first.
Okay.
Yep.
Explanation?
Yep.
Madam Chair, committee members, House Bill 3701 modifies the description of land in Linn County that may be open burned as steep terrain and species identified by the Director of Oregon Department of Agriculture, that has been identified by the Director, applies to open burning occurring on or after the effective date of the Act. No revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, no statement issued.
Okay, Senator Brzozinski, since you had worked on this bill last session, do you want to make a few comments?
Madam Chair, it came to our attention that there's a geographic area that's adjacent to what has already been designated in the original or the past bill that would was not included for being permitted to be included in the burn area of the 15,000 acres. This bill is will open up the geographic area from Senate Bill 528 to include that area, which is in the northern portion of Linn County. It's immediately adjacent to other geographic areas that was, in fact, included within SB 528, and it does not make any other changes, such as increasing acreage for burning. It just says that the geographic area that can be included for that 15,000 acres does, in fact, include this additional acreage that was unintentionally left out. I was also put on the record that when the bill was being drafted and the boundaries that were given to us for consideration, it was an oversight on their part to not include, I believe there's like a half dozen farms that are will be impacted by this, and it was determined that this was a reasonable request to be fixed, and I told the proponents that I would support this, and the other co-chief sponsor has agreed to do that, and that's why it's here now since it's gone through the House.
Okay, great. So we have Katie Fass signed up, and then I didn't know if the Department of Ag, did you want to come up? Why don't you guys come up together?
For the record, Katie Fass with the Oregon Farm Bureau. I have to say I think Senator Brzozinski did a very good job of describing the issue. You'll be receiving some maps from the Department of Agriculture. There were 11 fields that have been traditionally in the specified species of fine fescue that is allowed to be burned within the 15,000 acres that was allowable in Senate Bill 528 last session. This legislation brings in 10 of those fields, and if you can see by the map, the area that was excluded almost looks like a thumb sticking out, and so this levels out the line to bring in those acreage, and the Farm Bureau is in support.
Okay. Do you want to add anything?
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Ag. I don't have anything to add. We put together the map so you'd have a visual of the area that's being included and where the borders are moved.
Okay. And I just had a quick question. I thought I heard you say, Katie, that 10 of the 11?
That's correct. If you look at the map, there's one field that is in kind of the corner of the yellow. I think when we were talking about the drafting, that brings in a much different area than we'd seen. The lines were drafted with the help of the Department of Ag, and this was the suggested kind of easiest route.
Okay. And did you want to add anything? Okay. Questions? We lost Senator Prezonsky, so we'll wait. We'll see if we can grab him. Okay. Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3701, and we will wait for Senator Prezonsky to come back because he's going to carry it.
Okay,
thanks. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 3701.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3701 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Prezonsky moves House Bill 3701 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries, and Senator Prezonsky, I think it would be great if you carried this bill to the floor. Okay, with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3701, and we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 3693.
Yeah. Madam Chair, committee members, House Bill 3693A authorizes the sale of diesel fuel that otherwise meets the requirements of the state's biodiesel fuel standards, but to which substances have been added to prevent congealing or gelling of the fuel. Applies to fuel sold or offered for sale from October 1st of any year to February 20th of the following year. Sunsets this provision March 1st, 2011. There's no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact statement.
Okay. Thank you. And we have Bob Russell, Paul Romaine, and Katie Fast. You want to come back up, Katie? I'd like to testify on this?
I hear it. I'm starting.
Sure.
For the record, again, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau. This past winter, during the first week or second week in December, when we had the very extreme cold weather in eastern Oregon and throughout the state, I had received some calls and complaints from members of mine who had trouble with tractors not starting when they go out to feed their livestock, and diesel engines and their pickups not starting. And the concern was related to gelling issues. Additionally, the Department of Agriculture during that week received other complaints related to gelling of diesel fuel, mainly in the eastern Oregon area in Bend. I think this included anything from passenger vehicles to school buses in the Bend area that weren't able to start in the mornings. After discussions with Representative Cannon, he convened a work session or a work group the first day of session, which this panel up here participated with some others. The result of that is House Bill 3693. And the legislation allows an additive to be added to the 2% biodiesel standard to prevent gelling. And so that could be a chemical additive, or it could be kerosene, which is traditionally added to diesel fuel in the wintertime to prevent gelling issues. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, I think somebody needs to talk about the process that's used for blending, and I don't know if either of these two gentlemen are going to do that.
I think you have more experts than
okay.
I.
Got it. Paul?
Yeah. A little bit in.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm here representing the Oregon Petroleum Association. First of all, we want to thank Representative Cannon for basically getting a work group together first day of session to try and figure out, number one, was there a problem? Number two, if there is a problem, what kind of solution do we need? Katie described the problem that we had gelling. What we determined, we believe, is it's not a biodiesel problem, it's a blending problem. It's how do you put the stuff together? It's a little different substance. It gels at different temperatures. So, again, as she stated, the way you usually do this is in the wintertime you add number one diesel, which is kerosene, to the number two. The problem we have here is if we add number one diesel to the biodiesel, we go below the 2%. Because you're going to add anywhere from 35 to 50%, so you could have, you know, anywhere from 1% bio to 1.3% bio or whatever it is. So, and the problem, what we understand, really doesn't come in when it's blended properly under the right temperature conditions at a blending facility, at a terminal or something that's equipped to blend it. It's splash blending, where it occurs. And unfortunately, most of Eastern Oregon, that's really what you have right now. We have one distributor that's building a blending facility in Ontario that will, hopefully, it'll be state-of-the-art and be able to put everything together. But if you don't put this stuff together at the right temperatures, you end up with just kind of one and one, and they never mix. And that's where we ran into problems. So one of the suggestions came out of this was, let's make it a short-term fix, because you're going to be here next year anyway. So if we really didn't guess right on what the solution should be, then we'll come back to you. So we did this for only this next winter. Basically, we're allowed to blend beginning October 1st, because that's when we start delivering for the winter, and it ends at the end of February. So it's a limited duration, and it gives us time to basically figure out how to do this right, especially in splash blended areas, or maybe where we can get the fuel. We believe that we have a solution. The trucking associations and the petroleum association are going to sponsor a blending conference, which I'm sure it'll be thrilling, and you'll be all invited to come to at the end of July in Sun River.
I was going to say, I'm sure they'll be blending other things as well in Sun River during that time. But
well, actually, Madam Chair, one of the solutions to a gelling problem, frankly, is taking your bottle of whiskey and pour it in your tank, and that's what Representative Jensen used to have to do when his truck would gel up. So we want to save Representative Jensen's scotch or bourbon, whatever he's drinking, so we've decided to try this first. We believe, again, once we get everybody up to speed, that we won't have a problem, but it's getting everybody up to speed. Now, Department of Ag needs a compliment here, and we're going to give it to them, because they were very flexible. They basically took a very practical approach, because this is, it's a mandate of 2%, which is fine, but when the problem occurred, what the word they gave to everybody was make it work, because we don't want school buses stranded out there, or ambulances, or just plain old cars or pickups. So they basically said, we're not the bio police, go out and just make it work. And so they really do need to be commended for their practical approach, not the rigid approach. And again, we're trying to figure out what the problem is. If we know what the problem is, we can fix it and go forward.
So, Paul, and if you mentioned this already, I didn't catch it. Will the new facility in Ontario be up and running by next October?
Madam Chair, I don't actually represent that. Well, I do. They're part of the Oregon Petroleum Association, but they have stated they're trying to get it up and running, I believe, by April or May of this year. So they would be able to do stuff. But again, it's like, where does the fuel come from? And mm-hmm. This has to apply statewide, because somebody can fill up in Medford and drive 1,000 miles or more on a truck, one of the big trucks, and you don't know where they're going, different temperatures and stuff like that. So we have a statewide problem. We just have to figure out what it is. Fortunately, this winter we had only 3 weeks or so of really cold weather, so we sort of got a warning notice. This is a problem. And now you got a year to fix it.
And my understanding is that there wasn't the same type of problems on the west side, because that's where the injection blending is occurring?
Madam Chair, I believe there were a few problems, but not as prevalent as there were on the east side. But it's wherever it's real cold. That's
If I could add something also, another area where the Department of Agriculture received complaints is out at Klamath Falls, and I believe their fuel comes out of Northern California, not out of Boise through the Ontario area like the rest of Eastern Oregon. So while the injection facility, I think, will resolve quite a bit of the issues around gelling, it doesn't represent all the fuel coming in through Eastern Oregon in the cold parts of the state.
Yeah. Madam Chair, that's why we're having this blending conference, because fuel delivery, in, especially in the rural parts of the state, is it's your basic cowboy kind of. We just make it work. We get things out there. We take trucks out. We kind of dump it all together. And we have to make sure they're doing it right, because in this situation, in cold weather, if you don't do it right, it doesn't work.
Bob, did you want to add anything?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. I just want to say that I think this is a very reasonable approach to a very real problem. And I think it's important to note what this bill isn't, and it isn't a backdoor approach to try to repeal the RFS. And I would also like to commend Representative Cannon for his leadership. He did a great job in putting this together, and I urge your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel?
Well, I've had this happen to me. It's a real pain in the tractor.
I think we might have to
have thinking about you, Madam Chair.
I knew who was carrying this bill.
Madam
Chair, I'm trying to figure out the mixing of whiskey on cold days out there, and if, you know, how much of it goes into the actual tank.
Well, Representative Jensen already left, so we can't ask him that up on the witness stand. But, okay, thank you very much. Anybody else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3693A, and I will open up a work session on House Bill 3693A.
Yes, ma'am. I move House Bill 3693A to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 3693A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Do you want to talk about whiskey in your truck?
I understand cracking real well.
Okay. Any objections? Seeing none, I think it's very appropriate for Senator Boquist to carry the bill.
You can demonstrate on the floor.
You can demonstrate on the floor that whiskey blending.
So you guys will vote for the rule suspension when I bring the fifth on the floor.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. With that, the motion carries, and the work session is closed. And committee members, thank you for your hard work this session. Beth, thank you as always, because you are always there when we need you and on top of the bills. And appreciate all of your hard work. And Sue, sorry, I can't hardly see you over the computer. Thank you, staff, for all your hard work, and we will be having some interim hearings. We also, I want to mention, next week we have an informational hearing scheduled for early next week, so please check your email, and would appreciate if folks do come, because there's going to be some important issues discussed in that informational hearing. Thank you very much. That we're adjourned.